Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up in just a few moments, the Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith issues a note of warning to Catholics regarding the works of a well-known Jesuit theologian. The prestigious Templeton Prize is awarded to a Canadian Catholic philosophy professor who says the secular and the spiritual must be taken seriously in the search for solutions to problems of violence in contemporary society. And Pope Benedict focuses his general audience reflections on a first century bishop and father of the church. Welcome to the programme. The Vatican's Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith on Wednesday issued a note of warning to Catholics regarding the works of a well-known Jesuit theologian who has spent most of his career working amongst the poorest communities of El Salvador. Father John Sobrino was born in Spain but was sent to Latin America in the late 1950s, where he became involved in the struggles of the poor and the development of liberation theology. He was one of the founders of the Jesuit-run University of Central America, which was renowned for its criticism of abuses by the Salvadoran military government during the Civil War of the 1970s and 80s. In November 1989, he narrowly escaped assassination because he was in Thailand when six other Jesuits from his community were murdered by military gunmen. While praising Sobrino's commitment to the poor, the Vatican notification takes up six points contained in two of his best-known works, which it says do not conform to official church teaching.
This is not a personal condemnation. In fact, the congregation shows appreciation of Sobrino's option for the poor.
Father Greg Prosper is a member of the Vatican's International Theological Commission. He tells my colleague Charles Collins why it was necessary to issue this notification.
The document is a warning to the faithful that some doctrines contained in two books by Sobrino, nominally A Historico-Theological Reading of Jesus of Nazareth and The Faith in Jesus Christ, do not measure up to revealed doctrine and to official church statements. The warning has been considered necessary given the widespread circulation of these writings and their use in seminaries. Had it been just an article in some learned paper, I suppose that nothing would have been said against about it, and it would have been left to the discussion among theologians. But as these books are having widespread reading and also influence in seminaries, so I mean a warning was absolutely necessary. Now, in the introduction, in fact, the faithful are reminded that the Church, from its very beginning and throughout the ages, has always preached and practiced succor for the poor. The two documents concerning the theology of liberation, published about 20 years ago, showed this solicitude. They only censored the Marxist interpretation in some of these theologies.
What's the difference then between the option for the poor promoted by the Church and Father Sobrino's idea of the Church of the Poor?
Well, the option for the poor, of course, is that any Christian who thinks he is a real Christian should take the poor into consideration, because first of all, theirs is the kingdom of heaven, and the goods of this world belong to all. And so whoever sort of abounds in riches or whatever it is should have certainly solicitude for the poor if he is to call himself a Christian. The church of the poor is, in a way, is an invention, because, to put it simply, Sobrino does not follow the standard Catholic rules of the game in doing theology. Theology is a science, and it's got its methodology. united, of course, with the faith of the theologians. Beginning with sociological observation and forcing the data of revelation into the ensuing reflections is not correct. So, I mean, that is sort of the church or theology of the poor or from the poor. It's an adaptation of theological thinking and also the doctrine of the church into social, forcing it into sociological structures, you see. That is why then it's not a question of helping or not helping, living or not living for the poor. That, of course, is to be praised in everybody. But when it comes then to forcing theological formula to fit these sociological categories, it's there then that trouble can arise.
As well as questioning Father Sobrino's theological methods, the notification sets out five other points which it says do not measure up to official church teaching. These are the downplaying of the divinity of Jesus, the explanation of the incarnation, the relationship between Jesus and God's kingdom, Jesus' understanding of himself, and the doctrine on Jesus' atoning death. Father Grech says while Catholics may continue to read Father Sobrino's works, they must be aware of the ways in which they endanger the faith of the Church.
We are not speaking here of explicit heresy or of personal excommunication, but of theological statements which endanger the faith of the Catholic Church and the Credo itself. Jesus and the Son, the second person of the Holy Trinity, are intimately united in one person, that is, the person of the Logos. This keeps the Credo together. Now, Sobrino, in a way, if we can compare this, loses the nuts and bolts of this unity in such a way that the whole structure totters and threatens to fall apart, dissolving the Credo. So that is why it was necessary for the congregation to publish this notification. It's a question of telling the faithful, look, read Sobrino's book as much as you like, but remember that these points, which we have touched upon, are, let's say, dangerous for the faith if they're pushed to extremes. And some of them also touch, in a way, what we might call even heresy, because they contradict certain church dogmas which have been defined in the councils of Ephesus and Chalcedon by both Greeks and Latins, and to which all denominations, even Protestants themselves, recur when they speak about the interpretation of the Credo, you see.
You say this is a warning, but does the notification carry any sort of juridic effect or penalty put on the works themselves?
No, ma'am, they can't be called sort of prohibited, or because, of course, the index doesn't exist any longer. But it's just to tell the faithful that if they read these books and if they are used in seminaries, that these 6 points are not approved by the Catholic Church. And so they cannot be said to convey church doctrine. One word about the procedure. This is not actually a condemnation from above without consulting anybody. The author has been consulted. The congregation communicated these 6 points to the Father General of the Jesuit Order, who passed them on to Sobrino, and he had a couple of months to answer. He did answer, but it seems that his answer did not satisfy either the committee that had written them or the ordinary session of the bishops and cardinals that are members of the congregation. So they were taken over to the Holy Father, and the Holy Father approved the publication of this notification. That's how things run, you see.
Father Greg Prosper is a member of the Vatican's International Theological Commission. Meanwhile, in his general audience on Wednesday, Pope Benedict XVI spoke about a first-century bishop and father of the Church, St. Ignatius of Antioch, who urged the early Christian communities to be on their guard against emerging heresies and to remain faithful to the apostolic tradition. The Pope was speaking to thousands of pilgrims and visitors gathered in a sunny St. Peter's Square. My colleague Emma McCarthy takes a closer look at what the Pope had to say.
A loud cheer went up from the crowd as the open-topped papal car emerged from the gates of the Vatican City and toured the square, giving Pope Benedict the opportunity to greet his visitors. Once settled beneath the crimson canopy on the raised altar, the Holy Father continued his catechesis on the lives of the fathers of the Church, this week taking a look at the figure of St. Ignatius of Antioch.
He was the third bishop of Antioch in Syria from the year 70 to 107. While traveling to Rome to face martyrdom, he urged the Christian communities through preaching and letters to be on their guard against emerging heresies, to remain faithful to the apostolic tradition, and to maintain ecclesial harmony and cooperation.
Indeed, church unity was a predominant theme of the Pope's audience, with the word unity appearing again and again in his catechesis.
Among the fathers of the Church, Ignatius is renowned for his intense desire for union with Christ, even pleading that his martyrdom come quickly in order to be with Jesus. Ignatius taught that unity is a prerogative of God. And so for Christians, unity is an imitation of the divine. In his letters, he insists on communion among believers and with their bishops. Such harmony precludes any sense of opposition between ecclesial rules and instead echoes Christ's prayer that they may be one. Little wonder St. Ignatius is called the Doctor of Unity. His realism still prompts believers today to seek configuration to Christ and dedication to his Church through communion with our bishops and generous service to our communities and the world. Let us beseech the Lord for the grace of unity and strive to live the fullness of communion and mission.
As is tradition, the Pope then greeted the huge crowds in various languages, including English, before imparting his apostolic blessing.
I welcome all the English-speaking visitors present today, including the cardinals and bishops of the Clara Vox Committee, gathered in Rome to advise the Congregation for Divine Worship on the new English translation of the Roman Missal. I thank them and their assistants for the important work. Upon all of you, invoke God's abundant blessings of joy and peace.
And my thanks there to Emma McCarthy for that report on Pope Benedict's Wednesday general audience.
Thank you.
Canadian Catholic philosopher and author Charles Taylor has been awarded the 2007 Templeton Prize for Research into Spiritual Realities. Given annually, this award is the largest monetary prize, worth more than the Nobel Awards, to highlight the importance of progress in spiritual subject matters. Professor Charles Taylor, who teaches law and philosophy at Northwestern University in Illinois, has spent nearly half a century arguing that problems of violence in modern society can only be resolved by tackling both their secular and their spiritual dimensions. Born in Montreal in 1931, Taylor grew up in a Catholic home where both English and French were spoken, sparking an early interest in questions of identity within a pluralist society. It was while he was studying philosophy at Oxford University that he first encountered what he describes as an unstructured hostility towards religious belief. That in turn led him to question the so-called objective approaches of psychology, history, linguistics, and other social sciences.
My take on it is that we have to rediscover how broad and plural reason is. It's not simply a set of procedures of, you know, logical deduction and so on. And I think we have to really redefine what people understand as reason, which is far too narrow in our intellectual culture.
In recent years, the Templeton Prize has been awarded to mathematicians or researchers into the natural sciences, and Professor Taylor told me he was at first surprised to hear he'd been chosen for this prestigious award.
Yes, I was very surprised, but I mean, in retrospect, it's not totally a change in course. I mean, the brief of the foundation is really very, very broad to whatever can further the understanding of spirituality and so on. And they've chosen in recent years to focus on this very interesting issue of the relation of natural science to faith, and they've given the prize to people who've said something very interesting and new about that. But it's implicit in the whole idea of Sir John Templeton that one wants to break down this artificial barrier between sciences of any kind, I mean, or, you know, discipline studies of any kind, and spirituality, that the same kind of considerations could arise about the humanities and social sciences. And maybe even, in a sense, more urgently, because I think that our humanities and social sciences in many countries in the West, and Anglo-Saxon countries in particular, have been very often construed narrowly, let's put it that way, by practitioners who have thought they could more or less ignore religion as something that, you know, belonged to the past, or see it as not really important in the explanation of what human beings do.
Now, you've spent most of your career, haven't you, insisting on the need to include a spiritual dimension into the public debate, quite a countercultural position for British society. Do you feel there's been a change recently in public opinion that is coming more round to your views now?
Yes, definitely. I mean, there was a narrative, as it were, a secularization narrative that was there in the background, that religion belonged to the past, that modernity automatically leads to a decline in religion, and so you can ignore it more and more. And I think that the last 20 years have really badly shaken that, and people have reacted differently to this, of course, but it's just not possible to say that it doesn't affect us, or it's not something that's still very, very living and very important. You may be very against it. You may think that it's appalling that this is happening, but you can't really just ignore it. So there's begun to be a shift. It's very slow because, you know, academic disciplines are very, very conservative, but there is beginning to be a change.
Would you say that recently it's above all the rise in Islamic fundamentalism, perhaps, that is provoking this serious re-evaluation of the role of religion in public life?
Yeah, it's not the only thing, but I think it's probably the most important one, yeah. And in a certain sense, this is, I think, posing a real cultural and spiritual crisis for the West, because it's possible to respond to this in a way which is totally hostile to religion as such, in this case to Islam as such, and to clutch on to tremendously simple and homogenized views of Islam as something, you know, is essentially behind this kind of terrorist attack. as against understanding how tremendously varied and internally complex the Islamic world is, and so on. And I find it very worrying that a lot of public opinion in the West and in a lot of media and in a lot even of scholars who should know better, we find this kind of Islamophobia being fed and encouraged.
You're talking about the urgent need for new insight, aren't you, into
yes.
the human propensity for violence. But as you know, of course, religions, all religions, were and are still seen by many people as part of the problem.
Yes.
Are church leaders, therefore, or faith leaders in general, able, do you think, to transcend these past problems and offer any real insight or guidance?
Oh, I think undoubtedly, yes. I mean, for one thing, it's clear that much religion has been behind a lot of violence, or then much atheist ideology has been behind violence. And then many religious leaders have been very firmly on the side of attempting to overcome violence, to find peaceful solutions and to these problems. So there are people in both type of ideologies, if you like, in more faith positions, who are on both sides. And we have great tradition in the Christian church of people who have been working for peace. So we just have to build on those and make them our central understanding of our faith, and also, you know, repudiate those elements in our past which tell against this. I think one of the great things about John Paul's pontificate was that he was really willing to make this tremendously clear that we deeply regret those passages in our past that, in a sense, betrayed our commitment to peace as Christians.
Yet the Catholic Church tends to look at such violent episodes in the past by saying that individual people may have sinned, but the Church itself cannot be blamed for such violence. What's your reaction to that?
Well, I think that that's something very hard for people to understand. I mean, there's a certain sense of the church which is always God's church, which is a very deep theological notion, and therefore which in a way stands beyond all this. But most people don't understand that theological distinction. They think of how institutions operate. And when they see Pope Urban II preaching the crusade, you know, it's very hard for them to say, well, what do you mean there's no institutional responsibility here. I think that was a rather foolish thing to say. I mean, unless you can give the whole world a really deep understanding of Christian theology and the nature of the church, it needs to be put in a much more nuanced way than that.
You're talking about the important role of charismatic leaders. You mentioned Gandhi or Mandela or Archbishop Tutu, for example. How much do you think, then, that the acceptance of religion in public life today really depends upon people like this?
Oh, a great deal. I mean, people who otherwise might be very hostile are really brought up short when they you know, meet a figure like Tutu or any of these figures. So I think that a great part of the message, as it were, of the Church to the world passes through figures like that, who can really turn people around who have otherwise sharing these very harsh prejudices against religion and against the church and so on. Suddenly it gets through to them that there's something more to it than that when they read or meet figures like that.
You're very interested in this whole phenomenon of secularization, aren't you, and the rise of what you call new forms of religious belief and practice.
Yes.
What exactly do you mean here?
Well, I think that there are a tremendous variety of religious or spiritual or halfway between sort of religious and non-religious positions that are growing all the time. And it's a tremendous variety of atheist positions. I mean, if you think of the influence of Nietzsche over the last century and how that adds, you know, totally different themes to the ones that we had in the old forms of unbelief from Voltaire and Gibbon and so on. You can see that on both sides, and in the middle, there's constantly new positions that were not even imagined by our ancestors. Now, these are not only being propounded, they are all finding some degree of support, not some very, very small, some larger. I think that is going to be a continuing feature of modern culture, that that any faith position is going to have to swim in a sea of extremely diverse denizens and be able to speak to that.
And yet, of course, the established, the older churches tend to look at these new forms of religious belief as something of a threat rather than an ally. Does this kind of attitude worry you?
Yes. I don't think it's going to be fruitful, or from even evangelization point of view, it's going to be fruitful. What one has to do, I think, is to, of course, criticize other positions that are, you know, one really thinks are not correct, but also to have a sympathetic understanding of what moves people into those positions so that you can speak to these very deep impulses in people and you know, partial insights that people have that have put them in those positions. And if you just stand outside and condemn the old way, you're cutting off a very, very vital dialogue.
You were brought up a Catholic, weren't you, in your native
Yes.
Canada. How much did your own faith, or has your own faith, inspired your work over the years?
Oh, I mean, in a way, totally. I mean, it's been a thing that somehow is at the core of the whole thing. You have to, if you're doing this kind of work, you have to have, you're always moved by some very fundamental insights, which are very terribly vague at the beginning and not very much less vague now, maybe, but that push you forward and you try to define further. And mine have been totally bound up with my Christian faith, Catholic faith.
Pope Benedict and his predecessor, John Paul II, have also had a lot to say about the dangers of divorcing faith from reason or scientific inquiry. Are you very much encouraged, then, by these papal documents, these speeches?
Yes, I am. I mean, I have certain differences with the actual ways of formulating them and so on, but that basic line is one that I absolutely, entirely agree with. I mean, I think my take on it is that we have to rediscover how broad and plural reason is. It's not simply a set of procedures of, you know, logical deduction and so on. It has much more to it than that. If we go back to Plato, you can see that. And I think we have to really redefine what people understand as reason, which is far too narrow in our intellectual culture.
And my thanks there to Canadian Catholic philosopher and Professor Charles Taylor, the recipient of the 2007 Templeton Prize for Research into Spiritual Realities. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English programme for today. We'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then if you can. In the meantime, don't forget you can always find our news and feature programmes on the internet. Look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. You're listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.